John mentioned Israel My Glory magazine. I always tell people I'm a Jewish guy with a Jewish mission, and so I offer you such a deal. I always want a deal, right? Well, our table is over there. Larry Mitchell is there with his son Josh, and we have Israel My Glory magazine, and we'd like to give it to you. Some 250,000 people receive an issue every other month of Israel My Glory. If you'd like to go to our website, it's foi.org. I'd like to talk today or this evening, for those of you that are still awake, I'd like to talk and ask the question. Somebody already answered it. I had a fellow come up and said, yes. So I said, okay, you could go home. Just go home. You know the answer. It's a question that is often asked. Believe it or not, people wonder about Israel. In fact, if those who love Israel are worried about her, and I'm one of them, I'm worrying all the time. I mean, that's part of the Jewish makeup. I mean, it's just we're a stressful people. We're high stress. Something in the water in the Mediterranean. Italians, Greeks, Jewish people, if you tie our hands up, we go mute. We can't even talk. It's trouble. But I'd still like to address the question. And I'd start off by telling you this. And Bill, when he spoke on the fundamentals, quoted this verse. It's actually found in Jeremiah chapter 31 and verses 35 to 37. A number of years ago, I was with a colleague of mine, and we were in Chicago. We both lived in Chicago at that time. And we had a ministry at Northwestern University. For those of you acquainted with the school, some of the schools in the States, it's a Big Ten school. It's a large school. It's a well-known school. And we decided that we wanted to do a Bible study. And to attract interest, we were going to put an ad in the school newspaper. And the ad in the paper read like this. How to destroy Israel. Interested? Call. That was the ad. Now, I was with the organization longer than my colleague. And so when we discussed this Bible study and the ad, we agreed on everything. We agreed on the topic. We agreed on the ad. But then it came time to put a telephone number there. And so I told him, I've been with the organization longer than you. We're putting your number in the ad. Well, we did it that way. Sure enough, the school newspaper at Northwestern University called my colleague. They interviewed him. He made the front page of that school newspaper. And there was all kinds of questions as to what kind of group we are. We simply told them we were going to teach a Bible study on Jeremiah chapter 31 and verses 35 to 37, which was quoted for us just before, after we got back from supper. And it simply says this, if you could go up into the heavens and turn off the sun, it doesn't say it like this, by the way, I'm telling you, you could look it up, but if you could go up into the sky and turn off the sun, okay, so you got to find the light switch to the sun, flip it, and then the moon will no longer give its light, okay, but you're not done. Then you got to get your Stanley tape measure, you wear a tape measure here and you bring it out, you put it on one end of the universe, and then stretch it to the other end of the universe. And then you get back to the earth and measure the foundation of the earth. Now, if you take the Bible literally, as we are exhorted to do, a fundamental of the faith, wait a minute. Nobody can do that. There isn't anybody who has the ability to do those three things. Except one person, God. So, what the scripture is saying, that if you want to destroy the Jewish people, you must be God. Now, there have been people who have come in human history, in fact, in Jewish human history, who have thought that they were God and have tried to kill and exterminate the Jewish people. You can read about some of them in the Bible, particularly the book of Esther, That's one example. You could read in the intertestamental period, Antiochus Epiphanes. You could go to history not relatively long ago, to World War II and Adolf Hitler. They all thought that they were gods. By the way, they're all dead. And I'm standing here as a Jewish man. If you want to prove the authenticity of the scriptures, just do what Last Days Ministries is doing. They brought a Jewish person, John. He's here too. That proves the validity of the text. And today still, there are people, and we're going to talk about it, who want us to destroy all the Jewish people. By the way, there were Hittites, Jebusites, Amalekites, all kinds of ites. They're gone. They're gone. There were the Babylonians, the Assyrians. There are all kinds of people. They all wanted a piece of us. We're here. We're here. Now, that doesn't testify to anything I've done or John's done. You could give God a hand. Don't give me a hand. We didn't do anything. It is certainly God, like the Christian song says, God and God alone. Well, we're going to look at the question. Theodore, if I were to talk to you in the 19th century and ask that question, will Israel survive? It would be a crazy question to ask. Because in the 19th century, there was no Israel. There wasn't any Israel. So, talking the late 1800s, there wasn't any Israel. And a man by the name of Theodor Herzl, a secular Jewish man, grew up in Vienna. Actually, I can identify only in that part because I had two of my grandfathers who came from Vienna and immigrated to the United States. Vienna was a place where many Jewish people lived, and most of them were secular. So was Theodor Herzl. But he was assigned as a journalist to go to France, a very sophisticated place in the late 1800s, a cultural place. And there was a man, a captain, in the French army, Captain Dreyfus, Jewish man. And he was put on trial for treason. And it was Herzl who was assigned to go cover the story. And what he found as a secular man really frightened him. He found that while the trial was going on, many of the people he was meeting in France, in restaurants, in the hotel, on the streets, even in the newspapers there as they were covering the event, already had Dreyfus guilty, number one, and number two, were blaming all of Judaism, all of the Jewish people, for that. It concerned Herzl because he said, if this can happen in a place like France, it can happen anywhere. And so he established the first Zionist Congress in 1897, and he said this, if you will it, it is no dream. In fact, Friends of Israel is a book, I don't know if it's at our book table, written by Elwood McQuaid, called It's No Dream, A History of the Jewish People, and a marvelous book and helpful. It was during that same time, there was a man by the name of Mark Twain. You might be familiar with Mark Twain. He was touring just about 30 years before any of this took place. And I found it fascinating that Mark Twain called the Jewish people an enigma and an inspiration. From his point of view, in fact, the quote that he gives is an interesting one, at least from my point of view. He says, concerning the Jewish people, he's made a marvelous fight. He's using he, describing the Jewish people. Marvelous fight in the world. He's done it with his hands tied behind his back. That's what he said. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it, this great accomplishment. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, they filled the planet, and boom, they're gone. Now, he didn't say boom, they're gone. I added that to his thing. And then he goes on, he says, the Jews have beat them all, he fought them all, beat them all, And now he is, as he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, nor slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, he said, but the Jew. That's an interesting, this is in the 1850s, 1860s. Then he talked about the land he was traveling in. Now, several of you, how many of you have gone to Israel? Okay, see, okay, the land you saw, I don't even know what year you went. It doesn't matter. But the land you saw when you went, and the land that he saw when he went, two different, same place, two different views. He looked at that land and said, this isn't fit for jackals and owls. There is nothing here. It's barren. And indeed, in the 1850s, even at the time of Herzl, it was exactly that way. Now, we have a conundrum. Let me give you the conundrum. Here I have Mark Twain describing the land. And then we've already heard, again, when Bill spoke, and he alluded to so many passages, specifically in the Torah, first five books, Deuteronomy, talking about the Jewish people and the land, and the Jewish people being the chosen people of God. Chosen people of God. Talk to Jewish people today, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And you know what they say? Choose somebody else. Who needs the trouble? If this is what being chosen is, I want no part of it. Well, if you understand Jewish history, then you'll understand why they're going to say that. And so the conundrum is this. God's chosen a people and a land. The people that he chose were disobedient to him, even when he manifested his presence in full view of them. Look, read about in Exodus about the pillar of fire and the cloud. That's the presence of God, a theocracy. The Jewish people had a theocracy. But you know what our problem was? We wanted to be like you. We didn't want God to rule over. It's there's nothing spectacular about that. How many of you watched The Wedding? Either one. Long time ago, I remember my wife getting up real early to watch Diana marry whatever the guy's, I don't remember his name, a prince, whatever his name is. And then just recently, and now she's carrying the next ruler, whoever it is, Kate, right? And which one did she marry? Harry? What's William? I'm sorry, William. I'm really into this, you know. Anyway, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. There is. I mean, the horse-drawn thing, the Rolls Royce, whatever it is. It's spectacular. Now, that's what was going on amongst the Gentile rulers, too. A lot of pomp and circumstance. Jewish people, all we had was God. You know, we had God. And he was living in the first prefab worship center on the planet. And, you know, so he'd move around and we'd follow him. We didn't like that. We wanted a king, right? So when you think in terms of the Jewish people compromising, they were disobedient. And so they were scattered. God gave a promise to people, and he promised a land. The people were disobedient, and they were kicked out of the land. Those are biblical facts. Okay. There is a land for God's people and a people for God's land. Now, interestingly enough, when you read your Bible normally, I think I can't tell you anything more important than that. And we heard about it. Again, referring back to Bill's message, taking the Bible literally, which we should. I just say, read the Bible normally. The words mean what they say unless, okay, if you're reading poetry. I'm not into poetry. When I was in college, I was given an assignment as a freshman. It still haunts me. It still haunts me. The assignment was given on Monday. We had a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class. It was given on Monday. By Friday, turn in a poem. Turn in a poem. Okay. How hard is writing a poem? Well, I could tell you this. I was up a long time. I can't tell you, in those days we had typewriters. I can't tell you how many pieces of paper I threw. I can't write poetry. I just can't do it. And I had the grade, a D, to prove that I can't do it. I can tell you that there's some poetry in the Bible that you don't want to take literally. But if you read it normally, you'll know in the context not to take it literally. It's not rocket science. Now, when I say that, it reminds me. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville, Alabama has a which I was invited to speak in Huntsville, Alabama. And in fact, if you know Jewish history, this was a number of years ago. I told my mom that I was going to Alabama, and she said, "Are they making you go?" She was worried. The reason she was worried, in the South, the deep South of the United States, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. I would imagine there's still some in a lot of different places. But anyway, I told her, no, I was invited. I'm happy to go. Anyway, I'm in Huntsville, Alabama, and I tell the folks, this isn't rocket science, and they're all laughing. They're laughing like crazy. And I could not understand why. And after I finished, I went in the back, and a man came over, was in charge of the committee that brought me there, said, "You know where you are?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm in Huntsville, Alabama." He said, "You know what's right down the road from us?" No. He said, "Well, that's where they tested the Apollo rockets, which brought our men to the moon. In our church, even to this day, we have some of those rocket scientists." So, but it isn't rocket science. They're smart. The Bible wasn't given to rocket scientists. It was given to regular people. And when you read it normally, you can understand it and follow it. Interesting, though, if you read the Bible normally, notice here it says, "The Friends of Israel, 1938. That might not mean a whole lot to you, but it means a whole lot to me. Friends of Israel was started in 1938 by a group of pastors and businessmen. They were in Philadelphia. They were already seeing Jewish people from Germany. Adolf Hitler had been in power 5 years. During those 5 years, he already instituted some things that are ghastly, horrible, terrible things. Of the 650,000 Jewish Germans, a couple hundred thousand left. And many of them came down to New York and then went down to Philadelphia. In 1938, these businessmen and pastors said, we must do something for these Jewish people. They established the Friends of Israel Relief Society. Okay, that's really nice. But the key word, too, first, 1938, and second, Israel. There wasn't any Israel. There's no Israel in 1938. So why not call yourself the Friends of Jewish people? Or why not call yourself the Friends of Palestinians, which in that place, Great Britain was in control of that area in the that we call Israel today. But it was occupied by Great Britain. No, they called themselves the Friends of Israel because they believed in prophecy. Now, there was a vote in 1947. That vote occurred in November. By the way, initially the offer was given by the United Nations to the Arabs and the Jews of two states. You hear about two states today, right? Two states. Two equal states. Actually, they weren't quite equal. If you were ask me, biased as I am, but if you look at the map of what the offer was, it seemed a little skewed towards the Arabs. Now, you can argue about that, and that would be reasonable. But what is not arguable is that the Arabs said, no. Look, what was said about Yasser Arafat has been true historically about the leadership of the Arabs in this area. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Never. They never do. And he never did. So, by the way, they rejected that. The United Nations votes, and it would be May 15th, Great Britain would pull out. Now, what's an interesting story, again, from my point of view, and I think interesting from yours. By the way, right now, if you were to ask, who's the best friend to Israel? I would tell you Stephen Harper and Canada. No question. No doubt about it. I wrote an article about Stephen Harper a couple of years ago, and I tried to remember who it was, but I was reminded that it was Larry Mitchell who somehow got it, the issue of Israel My Glory, his daughter told me, in Stephen Harper's office. I don't know if he read it, but I think that's pretty cool. But 1947, the vote happened. Now, in the United States, the president at that time was a man by the name of Harry Truman. Harry Truman, the buck stops here, Harry. Roosevelt had died. Harry Truman was installed. And his mother read to him on a daily basis while growing up the Bible, literally on her knee. That's significant. You could read about it in his biography. She read the Bible to him regularly. In 1948, when it came time to recognize the state of Israel, every advisor that Harry Truman had said, don't do it. Now, not one advisor said to do it. Why? Well, Israel has 650,000 people in the country. They're surrounded by 150 million Arabs who want them into the Mediterranean Sea. There's no way they're going to stop them. They have no army, no navy, no air force. It's going to be over. There is going to be a stillbirth. And so, don't do it. Now, read the Bible normally. I don't know if Harry Truman was a believer. I don't have any evidence to one way or the other. But I do know he had understood the Bible, and it had registered in his being, because when it came to the time to vote for recognition of Israel, he remembered a biblical person by the name of Cyrus. If you remember your biblical history, Cyrus was the person who gave the Jewish people the opportunity to go back to the land. And once he realized from his advisors that he had the opportunity, America would be the first, maybe the only nation to recognize Israel in official capacity, he said this, I am Cyrus. That's what he said. I'm Cyrus. Somehow he remembered and he said, I'm in the same position, a leader of a country with the opportunity to do something significant, and he did it. And as a result of that, I personally believe, just like I believe for Canada now, in Genesis chapter 12, I will bless them that bless thee and curse him who curseth thee. So in 1948, Israel's recognized as a country, and immediately five nations attack. I already said, no army, no air force, no navy, nothing. They're going to go into the sea. It's going to be over. It wasn't over. Unbelievably. And if you read one of our books, I don't know if Larry has it there, Zvi, he's in our magazine. He's 80. Oh, give him a hand. Yep. Zvi survived the Holocaust, fought in the War of Independence at a time when most of the soldiers could not speak the same language. There was all kinds of trouble. They're coming from all these different countries. They survived the Holocaust. It was crazy. When I've talked to Zvi personally about it, one time there was an order to move forward, and they yelled forward. People were reversing. Some people were going right and left. There was no coordination because at that time the language was still relatively new. And so it was difficult. Yet, how did they win? They won. They won. Well, they survived. Well, then, a few years later, after Jerusalem is divided, the Temple Mount area, for those of you who've been to Israel, that was on the Jordanian side. By the way, all during those 19 years, there was no talk about Palestinian people. There was no talk about a two-state solution. There was no talk about injustice to the Palestinians. That was Jordanian land. They were not moving Amman to East Jerusalem. There was no Islamic chant about Jerusalem is ours. Never a talk like that. Never. Well, in 1967, as Egypt to the south is amassing huge army, to the north, Syria, Israel, first thing they do is talk to Jordan. And you could read about this in secular history. And they simply say this, it looks pretty bad as far as war goes to the north and to the south. We realize that there's going to be something's going to happen. We want you to just do nothing. If you do nothing, we'll do nothing. We're not interested in fighting you. I would think you would not be interested. Israel at that time was much stronger than Jordan. And so they told them, don't get involved and things will be fine. Well, the Six-Day War happened. One of the most amazing battles in all of military history, still studied today. The Air Force of Israel takes out the Egyptian Air Force in a matter of hours. Over 300 planes destroyed on the runway. Syrians to the north in the Golan Heights, the battle is raging. They pick up chatter, intelligence chatter. Egypt and Syria are talking to the king of Jordan, and they're saying, meet us on the shore of the Mediterranean, and we will toast to our freedom. The Jews are being run into the Mediterranean. They didn't have Twitter or Facebook. They didn't have any social media. The king thought, oh, this is great. Well, what was happening is, as we know, in 6 days, Israel was doing heavy damage north and south. And so you could talk to and read from the generals who were on the front of the western side of Jerusalem, who said the miracle of the Six-Day War is that Jordan attacked. And the reason they say it was the miracle, because they knew that if they attacked, they were allowed to counterattack and they could take the Temple Mount. And guess what? That's exactly what they did. And so in 1967, Israel, the city of Jerusalem, is united again. It's an amazing story. But then 1973, just a few years later, Israel's feeling pretty good about itself. They're strong. Golda Meir is a prime minister, female prime minister, who came from Europe to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, became a school teacher, but she had the call for Aliyah to ascend, and she went and worked on a kibbutz, and ultimately led to her becoming the prime minister. And there she is, and there's, again, on the borders, north and south, armies aligning almost exactly the way they did in 67. Except this time, since Israel has the Sinai Desert, that whole Sinai, they were aligning right by the border of the Sinai. And because of world opinion, Golda Meir didn't want to do anything. They knew they were there. In fact, what they did was what they had done normally since the Six-Day War. At Yom Kippur, everybody went, including soldiers, into the synagogues. Holiest day of the year. And so they had a skeletal crew to the north and to the south, and they attacked. It was a surprise attack, and it was one of the worst wars as far as casualties were concerned in the nation of Israel. A bitterly fought war. And it looked as though Israel was going to lose. There is what was called the Samson option. Ooh, the Samson option. That's something from the Bible. What did Samson do? Well, we know a few things he did. Number one, he went against his parents. That was his first mistake when he was younger, and it didn't get much better than that. And finally, when things were so bad, when Delilah did her thing, he's now the last gasp. What's he going to do? He's going to kill himself as he pushes on those columns and destroys all the Philistines, but he dies with it. So the Samson option was, if Israel's going to lose, they're going to take them with them. And to this day, Israel doesn't admit to a bomb, but they've had a bomb. Now, I don't know how many of you in Canada have feared, ever since, say, the late 60s, oh, Israel has a bomb. They might use it. None of us have. I grew up, but what about Iran? Now, if Iran has a bomb, is that a little different than Israel having a bomb? Well, I think so, and we'll talk about that shortly. But Yom Kippur, things turned. Right. By the way, our president was in a lot of trouble at that time. He did a good thing. His name was Nixon, Richard Nixon, and he sent some aid to Israel in the nick of time. It involved letting Russia know through satellites that the United States was there to help, and it was a big deal. The whole country, the military was on alert. I was in college. I remember a national alert in 1973. Well, Israel won the day, and they survived. Now, we come to trying to look at that period of time. At that time, the Shah of Iran was in Iran. Persia, it used to be called. It's Iran. Well, Shah of Iran was a Western-minded person. He wasn't an enemy to Israel. Many of the Arab states today that are really the hub of terrorism, at that time, weren't really involved in the geopolitical system in the Middle East. You had Turkey at that time, which was under Russia primarily, and not involved in the Middle East that much at all. Oh, have times changed. Egypt, Mubarak. Look, when Mubarak was leader of Egypt, he wasn't good to his people. Not at all. Terrible guy, terrible to his people. But when treaties were made, as they were before him, he honored that treaty, honored it. He kept the peace with Israel. He was stable as in a geopolitical system. Today we have a man who graduated with a PhD from USC, Southern California University, in engineering. He's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is around, at least in the United States. I don't know about Canada. I really don't know. I'm spending enough time just trying to figure out the United States. And I can tell you that the Muslim Brotherhood is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Our politicians have brought it up in our Congress. We've talked about it. And the Muslim Brotherhood, their slogan is jihad. That's their slogan. Now, Morsi is in Egypt. The treaty still stands so far, but it's in jeopardy. That treaty when Israel gave back the Sinai. Today in Iran, we've got Ahmadinejad. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Ahmadinejad and give you a scenario. This is my scenario. I know some other people hold it, but most people poo-poo it. Poo-poo, that's Hebrew for they don't think it's valid. I teach a course on the Holocaust. I teach it at a small Bible college in Iowa. And I can tell you this. In the 30s, well, actually in the 20s, there was a man who wrote a book while he was in prison called My Struggle, Mein Kampf. People in Germany saw the book, said, guy's crazy. He's a lunatic. We don't believe him. This is not going to go anywhere. But in it, he outlined exactly what he wanted to do. Exterminate the Jews and bring up the Reich of Germany to world power. He wrote it in a book. Now, in England, a powerhouse at that time, there was a man by the name of Chamberlain. His philosophy was appeasement, peace. People wanted peace. We all want peace. So give the guy what he wants. He's not really as crazy as you think. We can talk to him. He's a reasonable man. At the same time, there was a crazy person. He didn't have tight skin. He was a wrinkly old guy. His name was Winston Churchill. He was called a warmonger. And he said, I read the book, and I believe him. We've got to build our military. We've got to stop him. Oh, they said, you're crazy. You're a has-been. This is the way to do it. He flies. That is, Chamberlain flies to Germany. They eat together with Adolf Hitler. He comes back to, and by the way, that was the first time he flew. They actually flew to do diplomacy on an airplane. He flew there and flew back. And went to Buckingham Palace in front of thousands of people and said, you're going to be able to sleep well tonight. I have achieved peace in our day. That really happened. Not making it up, it really happened. 9 months after that speech, September of 1939, Germany attacks Poland and World War II starts, and the people throw out Chamberlain and beg for the wacko guy to take over. And by the way, that warmonger, if you read his speeches, he in a sense carried England on his back as he encouraged the people to fight on, that they could beat him. Okay. He hasn't written a book. But if you Google him and Google his speeches, you've been asked to Google a lot, you'll be up real late tonight. But if you do that, you'll find he didn't write a book, but he has written enough things to talk about he wants to exterminate the Jews, get rid of them, get rid of the little Satan Israel and the big Satan the United States. That's what he's writing. And most people who are in high places simply say, he's a little crazy, he doesn't really mean it, he can't do it. And if you believe, some of them will say, well, yeah, we'll try to stop them by just hurting their economy. That's what's been going on right now. And all along, he's still doing it. Now, the question simply is this. We are at a crossroads historically where we were before. In 1930s, the book was read by two different groups. Some believed him, some didn't, and we saw what happened. Now we're at a crossroads where some believe him and some don't. Now the question is, if he gets nuclear capability, is it too late? That's what they're discussing right now. The Prime Minister of Israel has already given the answer. He has said publicly, we cannot allow him to get nuclear bombs. We can't do it. And so it's a big question. What are they doing? Listen. He wants to destroy the Jewish people. He's talking about it all the time. By the way, same kinds of things they did in Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, they said about the Jewish people, oh, they're descendants of monkeys and pigs. That's what they're saying in Iran today. That's what he's saying about the people. Now, in our country, and so far Hegel has been pretty good, but question is, where is the United States in all this? Well, remember, thank God for Stephen Harper. Just about six or seven months ago when the Group of Eight met, and that was last summer, actually, so it's almost a year ago. Group of Eight can only say publicly, if they make a public statement, it means that all the nations are in agreement. Our president said, negotiations in Israel should start from the 67 borders. Ooh, that's not good. That's not good at all. And every nation except one agreed. And so they couldn't go public because Stephen Harper said, no, I veto that. And that's important and significant. It's interesting. Alan Dershowitz said this about the appointment of Hegel as the defense secretary. It was a great appointment for Tehran. I think that's pretty good. Well, I thought it was funny. None of you think it's funny, but I think it's funny. It's a great appointment for if your enemies like what you're doing, I would begin to question what you're doing. This will send a message to the imams, the mullahs, on the softness to nominate a man who's opposed to sanctions and is opposed to a military option. It's already tipping your hand as to what you will do and not do. Right now in Syria, by the way, over 75,000 civilians are being killed in Syria. They are using gas, sarin gas. They're gassing their own people. And the world isn't doing any. Oh, they're talking. Look, we all talk. Hot air. I'm good at that too. But there comes a point, if you're a leader, you can't just talk, you have to do something. We're not doing anything. And people are dying all over the place. We are at a crossroads. Now, Rivlin is a person who is in the government, he's in the Likud party, and he said, look, we're worried. Israel really is worried. They're concerned. Let me just read for you real quick, and then I'm going to close. But a couple years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu came to the Congress. Now, in my country, they don't agree on anything. Nothing. They don't agree on. They fight all the time. They don't agree on anything. They call each other names and yell and scream. And that's like all the time. He came to the Congress, and 39 times the Congress rose to applaud him. 39 times. They don't applaud their own people. Republicans don't stand up for Republicans, and Democrats don't even stand up for Democrats, but they did for... That hasn't happened. I don't know if it's ever happened, but certainly it hasn't happened in a long time. And when he came, listen in part to what he said. He said, in an unstable Middle East, Israel is the one anchor of stability. In a region of shifting alliances, Israel is America's unwavering ally. Israel has always been pro-American. Israel will always be pro-American. So today, the Middle East stands at a fateful crossroads. Like all of you, I pray that the people of the region choose the path less traveled, the path of liberty. No one knows what this path consists of better than you. This path is not paved by elections alone. It's paved with government's permit. When governments permit protests in town squares, when limits are placed on the powers of rulers, when judges are beholden to laws and not men, and when human rights cannot be crushed by tribal loyalties or mob rule. Israel has always embraced this path. In the Middle East, has long rejected it. In a region where women are stoned, gays are hanged, Christians are persecuted, Israel stands out. It is different. Of the 300 million Arabs in the Middle East and North Africa, only Israel's Arab citizens enjoy real democratic rights. I want you to stop for a second and think about that. Of those 300 million Arabs, less than one half of 1% are truly free, and they're all citizens of Israel. Think about that. There is a painting, a picture that's out there of what freedom could look like. There is a place of democracy that mirrors America and mirrors here in Canada, where you can stand up and say, I don't like this, and not be killed, shot, have your head cut off, or any. I want to worship this, or I want to worship that. Here we are in a conference, and we're hearing about things, quite frankly, when I hear about all the stuff that I heard, I'm in a, hopefully a good way, frightened because of all those spirits and all that, but we live in a free area. People can do what they want to do, even if it kills them or hurts other people, ultimately. In the nations that surround Israel, a nation of 5.5 million Jewish people, 7 million people surrounded by 250 million people, want them in the Mediterranean. There is an example. And you see, with all its amazing, miraculous background, Israel, even in unbelief, stands to the glory of God. God has brought them back. God has renewed them. And God will certainly in the future save them as a people. But Ezekiel chapter 37, the bones coming together, we're witnesses of that. It's happening. And there will be a day when Jesus Christ returns, and he's not coming to Calgary. He's not going to come to those snow-capped mountains. They're nice. I love looking at them. He's not coming to the United States. He's not going to Rome. He's going to Israel. And that's why, knowing that prophetic truth, the lead demon that's now attacking, those demons attacking all these people that we're hearing about, the lead one, Satan, is wanting to stop and thwart the Jewish people from existing and the land inhabited by Jewish people. He will fail. We read about it. We know the rest of the story in the book of Revelation. His feet will touch down on the Mount of Olives. It's going to split in two. It says in Zechariah, they shall see him whom they pierced and mourn for him as one mourns for an only child. They will know. Paul says in Romans, all Israel will be saved. When you read the book of Revelation, there's not a whole lot of us left. There's not a whole lot of Jewish people left. There's not a whole lot of Gentiles left. Billions of people dead. Horrible period of time. Why? Because God is going to accomplish his purpose. He will be glorified. There will be repentance. And the kingdom will stand. Not a German kingdom. Not a Canadian kingdom. Not a United States kingdom. But the kingdom of God, and it will be a messianic kingdom for 1,000 years. And even in that period, at the end, there's going to be unhappy people. There's going to be people who start in the millennium as all believers till the first baby's born. And then even with the king sitting there, by the end of that time, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who will join the loosed Satan for the final battle They'll all be thrown into the lake of fire, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. That's why we study prophecy, because there is victory in Jesus, and we can sing about it now. So, I am not Chamberlain, but I am telling you based on the Bible, based on the Word of God, sleep soundly and well tonight. Because even if we wake up in heaven, which is possible, the rapture can take place. But should we all wake up and be here for tomorrow's conference, we can be here in full assurance that we'll have a wonderful time in fellowship and we'll learn truth from His Word. Father, thanks for the Word. Use it in our life. In Jesus' name, amen.
I think it would be very fitting to sing a little song, a Hebrew song. Is that, Joseph, after he had found his brothers, or his brothers had found him, and the one question he asked, he says, "Does our father live?" And the answer that came back is, "Yes, our father lives. Israel lives, Jacob, the man." But it has now switched around. Does Israel live? Yes. Why? Because our father lives. And it goes, Oina veinu hai, Oina veinu hai, Oina veinu, Oina veinu, Oina veinu hai, Oina veinu hai, Oina veinu hai, Oina veinu, Oina veinu, Oina veinu hai. Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael hai, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael hai. Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael hai, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael hai. Israel lives. Why? Because our Father in heaven lives. He's the God of the living. He said He was the God of the living of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's the God we serve. And so I just want to say thank you, Steve, for being here.